The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
Here's Bill Meyer.
I have a lot to talk about these days when it comes to legal affairs. And joining me right now is Landmark Legal's Mike O'Neill. He's the Vice President of Legal Affairs, Landmark Legal Foundation, landmarklegal.org. Great legal mind. And there are just so many ducks, legal ducks, flying in the air here. I don't know worthy of being shot down or not, but Mike, it is great to have you back on the program. Good morning, sir.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm a little frustrated, though, in some respects, when I hear the White House the other day talk about, well, you know, we did not ignore the judge's order. It was in international airspace at the point. There's a part of me just said, no, just own it, and saying that we don't really think that you are, you know, that you really have jurisdiction over this. And why don't we break down what happened then with this? What is this 1790s era act that President Trump invoked? Could you help us understand this more?
Right. So this is a law called the Alien Enemies Act, and this is a law that was passed again. It's interesting. I think it reflects the genius of our founding generation that a law that was enacted in the late 1700s, 18th century here, is still applicable today. This was a law to ensure that the president had the necessary authority to designate aliens and take effective action to ensure the national security interests of the United States. Again, this is the president operating at the highest of his power. When the president is conducting foreign affairs or is exercising his legislative and constitutional authority to defend the national security interests of the United States, he is operating at the apex of his power. And so what the president did here was utilize the Alien Enemies Act to designate Trende Aragua, TDA.
You know, I stumble over that every time, too. Don't feel badly about that.
I got to work on my Spanish.
One listener said we have to change it to like Trende Agava or something like that, so we can not trip on it. But I get you. Okay.
Exactly. Well, he designated TDA as a foreign terrorist organization with connections and nexus to the Venezuelan government,
right,
well within his authority and under his prerogative pursuant to the Alien Enemies Act, said that these are narco-terrorists who had entered into the United States illegally and had conducted pretty much the most horrendous criminal activities you could designate. These are individuals who child sex slave rings, human chattel, narco-terrorism, dealing fentanyl, which has, of course, resulted in the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans every year. These are guys who are designated, who are deployed by entities within the Venezuelan government to essentially come into the United States and sow chaos. Well, what happened is the president identified these individuals. These individuals have been identified via the criminal justice system as affiliated and connected with this foreign terrorist organization. They were rounded up, they were put on a plane, and they were deported. They were sent to prisons in El Salvador, those prisons that you've seen that El Salvador president has instituted to ensure that his country is protected from those MS-13 gang members. So what happened was, of course, the left-wing legal apparatus, this massive entity, this massive institution, I'm just going to call it an institution, that has joined together, that has essentially opposed legally every single executive action undertaken by the president, ran immediately to a sympathetic court and sought an emergency injunction to stop this deportation proceeding. And the court essentially said, hey, look, this is a sympathetic judge in the D.C. District Court. This is a district court judge. This isn't an appellate court. This isn't the United States Supreme Court. This is a single district court judge. Issued an order well outside his authority, saying, "Well, no, you don't have authority here. You have to turn the plane around. You have to send these people back to America. They're afforded due process rights." Well, he's acting well outside the scope of his authority. This is an issue that is non-justiciable. This is an issue where a court has no jurisdiction to participate in this activity. This is a case where the president is exercising his foreign power authority. Essentially, it's again, and Stephen Miller said this, I think, yesterday, this is akin to a judge saying, hey, you can't deploy the 101st Airborne Division to the southern border, or you can't deploy an aircraft carrier to the Red Sea to protect the security interests of the United States of America. This is the president acting within, again, his Article 2 authority to defend the national interests of the national security of the United States, and a court has no authority here to jump in.
So, Mike, the legal blob, though, is very much it's now, instead of just lawfare, we now have judgefare, I think, to a certain extent. And what I'm wondering, though, is Do we have truly three co-equal branches of government, or maybe four if you want to include the administrative state, you know, that sort of thing? How do you see this? Because, you know, this judge is even today asking for an explanation. Hey, why didn't you follow my order? And it really concerns me that absolutely everything has to be run through the courts these days, or even people act as if everything has to be run through this court and through the courts, and that this is something which is totally acceptable. And I don't see any aspect in black letter law which authorizes it, but it's kind of, is it the lie we're all supposed to believe right now? How would you break this down for us to understand it more?
Right. I think what you have to understand here is that the courts, the judicial system needs to police itself, and it starts really at the top. John Roberts is not the Chief Justice of the United States, of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He's the Chief Justice of the United States of America. And it is incumbent upon the judiciary, again, through the appellate process. The appeals courts have the power to overrule and overturn lower court decisions, and then ultimately the judicial power rests with the Supreme Court of the United States. I think there is no inherent enforcement authority that courts have other than the fact that we all have faith in their institutional power.
Right.
And I think in order to ensure that the American people do not lose faith to the extent that it's already been lost, or to regain it to the extent that it's already been lost, is that the judicial branch has to get its house in order, and it has to start with the United States Supreme Court, ensuring that these judges who are exercising their authority well outside of any kind of constitutional authority they have are reined in. And if the court doesn't do this, if the Supreme Court doesn't act sooner rather than later, and I mean within weeks, any kind of institutional respect that the American people have for the judicial system is going to go out the window. And unfortunately, under our system, of course, you understand that Congress does have some role here to play. They do have, remember, they passed the Judiciary Act. They have an authority over the lower courts. The Supreme Court is the only court that is actually discussed in the Constitution. And so the Congress can establish and dilute the authority, can increase the number of federal judges. There's all kinds of authority that Congress has. Look, I don't want to see it going that way. I want to see the judiciary keeping its own house in order.
So you don't think then that Congress should just strip the federal judgeships of certain jurisdiction, or should they?
I haven't gotten to the point where I think impeachment is necessary yet. I want to see the courts rein in. I want to see the courts get their own house in order. I want to give the Supreme Court the opportunity to rein in these judges who are exercising authority well outside, you know, exercising power well outside their authority. I haven't gotten quite to the point where these judges, a lot of people on our side are calling for impeachment of these judges, and I haven't gotten quite there. I want to give the opportunity to the appellate courts and the Supreme Court to actually rule on a couple of these issues, rule on this specific issue that we're talking about, and also rule on the general issue about whether a district court judge has this authority to issue these nationwide injunctions. I think that's a bigger issue that really should be grappled with specifically in front of the Supreme Court. And again, I don't think that a court should have that. I don't think a single judge sitting in Washington, D.C., or a single judge sitting in Oregon, for that matter, should be able to issue an injunction, a preliminary injunction, or some sort of remedy that affects the entire nation. I think that that's an unconstitutional.
Yeah, and that just seems an overreach on its face, just with common sense. Yeah. I mean, for the entire country, when you're a district court judge, and not saying that a district court judge doesn't do important functions. Okay, I'm not saying that. Michael, we're having all sorts of problems when it comes to respect for the institutions. And you said that is it up to the Supreme Court to essentially smack down the judge that is going against President Trump with the Alien Enemies Act? And how do you smack that down? Is it just where you say, hey, you just completely reject the whole concept of the order whatsoever? How do you do it in a way that the judiciary understands that they're serious about this and knock this nonsense off, judges? Okay.
Right. So there. What happened was, from a technical standpoint, the judge issued a temporary restraining order. It actually affects, and that's an emergency remedy that's sought on an emergency expedited basis. That not necessarily is appealable, but it essentially functions as a preliminary injunction, and that's an appealable order. It goes to the circuit court, which is D.C. Circuit Court, which is the appeals court. They can rubber stamp it, say, okay, it was properly issued, goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, look, this is a non-justiciable issue. The courts do not, Article III judges, district courts, circuit courts, Supreme Court do not have jurisdiction here, and say that the order was declared improperly issued, and that's it, ends it. The Supreme Court has authority that say this is a non-justiciable, courts do not have jurisdiction in this, the order was improperly granted. That will rein in and will restore the balance of powers here. I think that is what procedurally can be done in this case. So That's the first step. The next step, of course, is addressing the larger issue about this nationwide injunction. That's something that needs to be done on, I think, a little slower basis, because there needs to be an opportunity for a more fulsome and more complete briefing in those particular issues, mm-hmm. because that's really a larger question, is what authority do judges have to issue nationwide injunctions? But particularly on this issue regarding these enemy terrorists, these narco-terrorists, it can go up fairly quickly. Court can say, look, non-justiciable, court has no jurisdiction, improperly ordered, improperly issued order.
And by the way, why should we bring them back is what I would add. You almost wish they could put a little post-it note on it. By the way, don't be stupid. We don't need these people around here, okay?
You get the message. Yeah, but the thing, again, when the Supreme Court speaks, it resonates with the entire country and the judiciary. And this is part of the reason why I respect the Supreme Court as an institution. Their voice carries a lot of weight. I lament when their voice is diluted. I lament when the American people lose faith in the integrity of the Supreme Court. When, for example, interestingly, the court had an opportunity to do this with the USAID funding a couple weeks ago. If you remember, Justice Alito and four other justices joined in a really strong dissent, and I think was very complete and laid out a lot of issues about why it was improperly brought that this court issued, that a district court, again, ordered the funding for the USAID money to come back. Court had a chance to set the record straight there, passed on it. I think they're going to have another shot here with this narco-terrorist case, and I don't think they should miss their opportunity.
Okay, I hope you're right about that, Mike. Mike O'Neill from landmarklegal.org. Mike, I wanted to touch on to something. Our Attorney General in Oregon, Dan Rayfield, never sees a multi-state action that he doesn't want to join in that has to do with trying to cut Trump's head off legally, you know, that kind of thing, every time it happens. I'm kind of wondering, what is the purpose? I've noticed that all of these state attorney generals, mostly in the blue states, have filed lawsuits almost like demanding that people get hired back in the Department of Education and various other federal agencies. And I'm just wondering, on what legal basis can a state order somebody to be rehired at the federal government? Something is just... I'm finding it offensive on its face, even if I might agree with why they want to do something. I don't in this case, right. But where are we going here? What do you think?
Yeah, excuse me. I think what you have is these guys are politicians, and they understand that their base now, which it's amazing. I think the political winds are clearly indicating that massive support for these policies of Trump. I'm baffled by the political calculus that some of these politicians are utilizing backing these ridiculous policies. I mean, you have the president of the United States who ran on combating waste, fraud, and abuse, and for trimming federal government and getting the United States fiscal house in order, and he's doing just that. And yet you have these, again, blue state Democrats who are trying to wage lawfare to try to stop everything. And I think really at base it's to score political points with their base. Oh. There's nothing in the long term gain politically from it. I think the American people recognize it. Again, I question the legality of it. Do these states per se have standing to challenge this? It all harkens back, I think, to the unitary executive, that the president retains ultimate executive authority to terminate employees of the executive branch for whatever reason. The Constitution vests the executive power within the president of the United States. I understand that there's civil service acts, but ultimately the president is trying to get the United States' financial house in order and has identified arms of government, apparatus of government, part of these administrative agencies that have functioned, really done nothing over decades.
Yeah, and if the money's not there, the money's not there. Or if we decide the money shouldn't be there, that's all there is to it, I guess, right? The Fed should be able to do that.
I think so. And I mean, again, the political, the people spoke. Donald Trump ran on this exact platform. He made no secret of the fact that he was going to identify waste, fraud, and abuse and cut that. And what is the crisis here? The overarching issue here is the fact that we are facing close to $40 trillion in national debt that is unsustainable. And our country is poised to go off a fiscal cliff if we don't get our financial house in order. And so it's incumbent upon the president and be it Doge, utilizing any of the tools that he has at his disposal to identify these agencies that are no longer functioning, that are essentially wasting American taxpayer money, and to make the necessary cuts. Now, it's going to be painful, but it's painful today, but it's going to be a lot less painful today than if we have to do it in 10 years when we have debt that's utterly unsustainable.
And it's also painful to bankrupt yourself openly.
Exactly.
You know. So, Michael, I have one quick question. This is reacting to what you said earlier, in which you think it's very important that people be able to respect the Supreme Court and the judiciary. And I will agree with you. I have a real concern. I don't know if you have an opinion on where this could go, but there is the Bruner decision in the Second Amendment a number of years ago, which made it very clear that you are not to be banning, states are not to be banning arms in common use. And yet state after state, especially once again in the blue world, Oregon is an example. There was a measure 114. The legislature is looking to then do measure 3075, House Bill 3075, which will more or less put that into effect. 114 essentially shuts down firearm sales here in the state of Oregon because it cannot be complied with. And the courts and the state legislature continues to go further and further in here. And it's like they're going to put us all out of business here the way it's looking. And what I'm wondering, though, is that they're all ignoring Bruner. Everyone is seems to be ignoring Bruner. And it does make one not respect the institution so much. What do you believe might be going on with this? Is this something where the Attorney General Bondi ends up having to start cracking heads? What would be the proper procedure in many ways?
I think the proper procedure is to have well-represented or clients who have been adversely affected by infringement on their Second Amendment rights to bring strong lawsuits in federal courts and prosecute them. Again, when I mean prosecute them, I don't mean criminally. I mean procedurally, push this. If there's laws that are passed by states that run afoul of the Bruner decision and violate individual Second Amendment rights, then it should be litigated. Again, you're talking to a lawyer here, so this is going to be my answer.
And once again, though, this is years, and the Second Amendment right in Oregon doesn't have years to litigate this because it's going to be shut down pretty soon. It really will be the way it's looking.
I think that's terrible. I think that you need to get a group of plaintiffs together to bring a lawsuit, fund it, find advocates who specialize in Second Amendment law and advocate and litigate those cases through the federal courts and then push it. I mean, I know that you guys are in the Ninth Circuit. I know the Ninth Circuit is generally amenable, and then push it as far as you can legally. Again, you work within the system to effectuate the necessary change. If you have the Attorney General and you have the state legislature that are running, again, violating constitutional rights, the important thing here is the Second Amendment rights are just as important as any other rights, right to free speech, right to practice religion. I know it gets short shrift, but there has to be necessary respect for those decisions. And if it can be argued that you're violating your Second Amendment rights and running afoul of the Bruner decision, then those cases need to be prosecuted.
So it's likely if they pass this bill this week, it will likely once again be fight it in federal court because it doesn't seem you can make any progress in state courts right now. I know that. What it's looking like
exactly.
Right now.
You allege a violation of your constitutional rights, and that brings in federal jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. Michael O'Neill, once again, Landmark Legal Foundation, thank you so much for the analysis of this. We really appreciate your take on it. Always good having you on. Be back. Okay. Thank you.
Take care, Bill. Bye-bye.
Michael O'Neill. It is 729 at KMED, 99.3 KBXG.
Hi, it's John at Wellburn's Weapons. The only thing better than shooting is shooting with a suppressor. Wellburns is Southern Oregon's
.com. This is the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
7:32. Thank you for waking up here this morning. We're going to be kicking it around with former State Senator Herman Bearchicker talking about a couple of bills that are on his mind here this morning. I wanted to also do a couple of emails of the day sponsored by Dr. Steve Nelson and Central Point Family Dentistry. CentralPointFamilyDentistry.com. It is on Freeman Way, and that's right next to the Mazatlan Mexican restaurant, which is right down from the McDonald's. So it's like McDonald's, Mazatlan, and then Dr. Steve, okay? By the way, they have a kiosk there that if you need some specialized mouthwashes, toothpastes, brushes, maybe even a water pick. I bought a water pick from them there. They'll sell them to you at his cost. So no markup on that whatsoever. Wants to make sure that you have the tools necessary for healthy teeth so they don't turn into teeth as you lose them. You know, you didn't want you losing them, right? In fact, I'm even working right now on the water pick trying to save a back tooth here to see if I can get the pocket closed up. One of those things that's been my homework from Dr. Steve Nelson. I want to give an email of the day to Hans Albuquerque, who writes me quite often and says, Bill, judicial tyranny is out of control. This is kind of going back like what I was talking about with Mike O'Neill from Landmark Legal. And Hans says, a one-third branch of government has become your daddy on every issue. If you don't like something political, just run them up to some appointed judge's robe and you'll get your way. Article 1 and 2 be damned. Reminder, judicial review is not in the Constitution, Bill, but was finagled in by Justice Marshall after the Jefferson election. Even Thomas Jefferson himself opposed it, yet slip and fall lawyers over the centuries have bastardized it into the spoiled child that it is. Congress has always had the power to rein it in, but never has. The Federalist Papers denounced the judiciary resting decision making to Congress and the executive branch. Why? Because those branches are derived from the electorate. The least power was imputed to the judicial branch, but here we are, day after day, waiting for some no-name judge with no authority to make some stupid decision that is completely outside his constitutional boundaries. Little pushback. We Americans just ride in the back of our China-made U.S. station wagon like dogs, heads and tongues sticking out the window. It's time to pressure our Congress critters to impeach the judiciary. What are they going to do? Sue us? It's a very good point. We have Patrick also weighing in that writes, Bill, the legal standing of President Trump to deport the criminal aliens that were deported and his full authority to do so stem from the oath of office that he swore. I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that I will and well faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which I am about to enter. So help me God. As the president declared that these crimes are terrorists, I think the matter is pretty much settled. Now, I had Anthony that wrote the also kind of a fun thing. And you know something, Bill? I don't think that they should have the credibility of saying the name correctly. The Tren de Aragua, the terror group, right? So take how we don't give mass murderers the attention of saying the name. I say from now on that cartel should be referred to as Tren de Agava. I love that. Tren de Agava. You know, some gender-confused tropical fruits. So, all right, I appreciate that. It's kind of funny. I appreciate that. Tamara writes me this morning, Bill, have you heard anything about flooding on the Klamath? Just wondering what's going on without the dam. Tamara Slocum. Tamara, I have not heard anything about that. And if anybody has had an eye on it, if there's been a problem, let me know. The email, Bill, at BillMeyerShow.com.
It's the biggest sales month here at Plan Z. Hi, this is Zola from PlanZDiet.com.
Wop on KMED.
Hi, I'm Jim with the Beauty Mark Salon and Glitter Bar, and I'm on KMED.
I've always loved that song, Let It Rain, from Clapton. And, of course, it's been raining and raining and raining, and it will rain a little less later today and then dry out until we get another storm series coming in for tomorrow. Former State Senator Herman Bertschinger on the program right now here, too. And like I said, you called in yesterday, Herman, and you were talking about how the water just came through your land and through your farm. And I guess just a mess. You got it all cleaned up today. Is it finally retreating, or is it still pretty high right now?
No. We're back to normal. There's no water anywhere. It's gone.
Oh, good. Well, just like you said, it tends to come quickly and then goes away just as quickly, usually. Nothing else.
Yep. That's just, and it wouldn't have happened if the Fort Benoit Creek didn't leave its banks. And the reason it left its banks is because all the trees that are growing in the middle of the river. And the only reason all the trees are growing in the middle of the river is Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife won't let us take them out.
Is it one of those things where the permitting process is really high, has to have a high bar, you have to show a real danger before they let you take something out of the creek, and everything's
there
about the fish?
No.
Oh, okay. So, well, the whole thing, it's kind of like we think we own our property, right? That kind of thing?
Well, I've lived here for 47, almost 48 years. And this is probably the fourth time that it has flooded the school and have done damage. And, you talk to the school to try to enlist some help. They're not going to get involved, It's just, nobody wants to do anything. Nobody wants to take on the state. Nobody wants to push. And so, school's out, school's closed. Maybe it's open today. I don't know. It wasn't open yesterday. And they had the companies in there, vacuuming all the mud and stuff out of the classrooms and stuff. So, there's your taxpayer dollars hard at work. And all it would simply take is to go through and clean that creek out.
Well, one thing which has been on my mind, and I was kind of intrigued by this, Florida State Governor Ron DeSantis ended up floating a plan the other day that I would love to see occur in Oregon, in which they eliminate, they just eliminate entirely the concept of the property tax, which would, go, I think, certainly help. And it might even then encourage the state that maybe we don't get involved in development any longer if they were no longer getting money from property taxes. We would then have to go to some form of a sales or consumption tax. But I know that Oregonians have had a almost like a birthright aversion to sales taxes, and I understand that. But wouldn't that ultimately help us out in the long run? What would you think about that? Any thoughts?
Well, I'm sitting here. I'm kind of wondering, you know, when have you started drinking so early in the morning? These things are never
going to
happen.
Well, the thing is, you know, in Oregon, and of course, with many places in the United States, we can never own our property. We never own our property. You're always owing rent, whether it's to the state, to the school district, or to the county, and you never have that ability. And it causes a lot of problems in our lives, including something like this, where you're always asking for state permission to be able to do something that you should be able to do because it's on your land and affecting you, you know, that kind of thing. But what do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I agree, but it's simply not going to happen, you know. So, you know, you might as well read Aesop's Fables.
Okay.
So, anyway, yeah. So a few bills. I want to give a couple examples. There's I don't know how many bills. I'm going to say there's over 4,000 bills easily, but I was just kind of snooping a little bit. But this is how stupid. Listen to these bills. Some of them are just stupid. Senate Bill 35, it requires the Oregon Health Authority to study medical assistance.
To study what now? Medical what?
Medical assistance. Okay.
I don't understand the word you used. I'm sorry. It's not coming through the phone. Let's try one more time. The Oregon Health Authority has to study medical what?
Assistance.
Okay. Yes. Why do they have to study medical assistance? That just doesn't make sense.
Exactly. Here's another one. The Department of Consumer and Business Services to study patient billing. And there's another board.
Why can't they do that as part of their normal work schedule anyway?
Exactly.
Okay.
And Senate Bill 37 requires the Board of Pharmacy to study pharmacy.
Okay. All right. Who is pushing this kind of stuff and why?
It's in the governor's office. Requires the Board of Pharmacy to study prescriptions.
Does it have some higher meaning for it? Like, you know, why are we writing so many of them? Or, you know, are we writing them for the wrong things? Do we have pill mills? Is there anything in there that you can discern?
This is what Senate Bill 39 requires the Oregon Health Authority to study health care.
You'd think they would have studied it plenty by this time here. Man.
You'd think we'd have a handle on it. Wouldn't you think so, Bill?
Yeah, so these are just a handful of the 4,000 or 5,000 that have been submitted for consideration. Okay.
That's right. I mean, like I told you earlier on off air, we could sit here until midnight talking about this. Senate Bill 77 describes allowable home occupations on land zoned for forest and farm use. What they want to do is anybody that has a home occupation that lives, they want to eliminate that if you live on high-value farm or forest land. You can't have a home occupation.
Is this the bill that would be going after you, especially if you have a business on this high-value farmland and they would limit the amount of people that could work for you?
You could have nobody work for you.
Nobody work for you. Okay.
You can't have the business.
All right.
And, you know, I get a lot of flack on social media when I talk about Oregon's not a business-friendly state.
Mm-hmm.
There's a great example right there.
Okay. You know, there's another bill that I'm aware of, too. Have you heard of, I don't have the number in front of me, but have you heard about the bill that wants to increase our power rates by 3% and put it into a state fire insurance fund of sorts but it also ends up, from what I understand, it also gives Pacific Power some legal relief in some ways. And it's just like, I love that. I'm already paying a lot for fire insurance, and then they wanted me to pay more fire insurance through the power bill going to Pacific Power to help Pacific Power fight the fires that it starts with its own lines. Isn't that weird?
Yeah, well, Bill, how many times have I talked on a show that the state wants to get out the money for fighting fire out of the general fund? And they are going to continue that, because that way it frees up general fund money that they can go and spend on all their little pet projects.
Senate Bill 762, by the way, Senator Golden says this week that he may actually get that that fire map repealed. Do you take him at his word on that?
Yeah, and there's a bill in the Senate and a bill in the House both repealing it. So I believe it's going to get done. I don't think they're going to repeal the whole thing, but they're going to repeal the fire map part of it.
Is that enough in your word or in your review?
Well, you know, you can only get so much. Some of it's already been implemented, so that's just, you're not going to repeal that. So I would say that's a huge step in the right direction. Let's put it that way.
Okay. All right. But I'm kind of with Jeff from Selma. You know, he's one of those guys that has done undo762.org. Mm-hmm. He looks at it as just a, like, you know, when you're in a war and you're getting pushback from the village and the state legislature is just retreating to the next village down the line. And it's just a strategic retreat. Ultimately, they'll continue to keep coming after you. Would you agree with that analysis of it?
Well, yes. No bad idea ever goes away.
Okay. What other bad ideas or great ideas do we see coming out of the state legislature? Herman Bertschinger, by the way, former state senator, is going through some of the bills which are out there in play right now.
So Senate Bill 78 establishes maximum size of replacement dwellings on land zoned for forest or farm use.
Boy, there's nothing with a bill like that that wouldn't be ripe for abuse when it comes to property rights, huh?
Well,
just from the sounds of it.
That's tied to 762 in some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is, say you have a 4,000-square-foot home on forest or farm land. It burns down. When you go to rebuild it, you may be limited to a 2,000-square-foot home. So,
you know something, Herman? We've been told by lots of people from the left that this whole concept that we've been talking about, well, there's the Great Replacement and various other conspiracy theories which have been out there, but the one about sustainable development and getting people off the rural lands, what part of that bill that you talked about wouldn't be part of getting people out from living on rural lands? It's connected, isn't it?
It makes it more difficult. Absolutely connected. And then the very next bill, so that was Senate Bill 78. Senate Bill 79 prohibits dwellings in sensitive or unsuitable areas within high-value resource land.
How do they define sensitive?
Well, who knows?
Sensitive meaning that the politicians that be don't want you there, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
It's all to get you out of there. Then let's see. Senate Bill 81 requires the Oregon Climate Action Commission to study natural climate solutions.
A natural climate solution. In other words, ride a horse instead of your car, right?
Right. Then we got Senate Bill 916. This is for the unions. Remember, so we have the unions, the tribes, and the environmental community. That's what keeps the Democrats in power in Oregon. So this one's for the unions, Senate Bill 916. Let any union member who is on strike to collect unemployment.
Bad idea. Bad idea. There is nothing worse than taking unemployment benefits that employers have to pay in. A lot of people don't realize that, Herman, that that the workers don't pay into the unemployment insurance fund. Employers do. And they get rated on how much they pay based on the type of employment and how often they end up firing or laying off people. You know about this, having run a business. And the thought that you would actually pay unemployment benefits paid for by employers so that workers can fight with their employers, there's no conflict or corruption there, is there?
Yeah. And so now we have Senate Bill 83, makes changes related to building code standards for wildfire hazard mitigation. So what I see is going to happen with 762, Bill, is they're going to repeal a bunch of that stuff, and then they're going to come back and take each one of the issues one by one and create a law. And this is one of them. So Senate Bill 62 makes changes related to building code standards for wildfire hazards, and so now they have a standalone bill that does that.
It's still about trying to force the people to harden their properties so the federal government can burn through the area, right? I mean, ultimately?
Yes. They may not do it all this session. They may do it over a period of time. Let's see. Senate Bill 84 exempts local governments that adopted and continue to enforce certain wildfire hazard mitigation standards from the application of state standards that are based on specific wildfire hazards classes.
Could you translate that for us, please?
That means that the counties can make laws that are to a higher standard than the state laws.
Is that necessarily a bad idea? To allow the counties to do a higher standard if they feel that's necessary?
Well, it's more local control, but it just depends on which county and who's elected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So. In other words, from the sounds of it, Herman, what I'm hearing here is that as long as the state legislature is in session, we're doomed until they sign EDI.
It's always like that. Somebody asked me, you know, is it ever going to get any better? I said, no, it's going to continue to get worse. Because as when you have the progressives in charge like this, they got to come up with these crazy ideas. And so then they get something passed, so now they got to go find another crazy idea.
Is there a tipping point, do you think, in which Oregon becomes an uninhabitable area for most people?
Well, I think we're approaching. We're at a negative growth state.
Mm-hmm.
We're anti-business. We don't have big business. I went through that, you know, a couple weeks ago with you. We're going backwards. I mean, you look at like Wyoming, the legislature just passed a law reducing property taxes.
And Florida is talking about eliminating property taxes entirely.
Right.
Let me ask you, this is a philosophical question. I've been saying for years that, a greater Idaho situation, which has been proposed, and many counties have voted for it. I understand why they want to do this. It's a high lift. It would be very difficult to accomplish. But, of course, things which are very difficult to accomplish are sometimes very important things to do. Is there a possibility that you think in if Oregon ends up weakening itself, because the state of Oregon, everything you've been talking about so far seems to be designed to weaken Oregon. It might be trying to strengthen control, but it's actually going to weaken the Oregon government over time because they're going to continue to run out of money over time. And there's only so far and so hard that you can tax a declining tax base in a declining business sector. You ever think there might come a time in which they would say, all right, rural lands, go ahead, take off. We don't have the money to be able to deal with you anymore. We're tired of you being a welfare state. They always call us welfare counties anyway, you know, down here. Do you think there's ever a point that politically they might see an advantage in letting us go and then just mess with Eugene and Portland all they want? What do you think?
No.
You don't?
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
No, because they love. You don't understand. You just don't understand how they think, Bill.
Oh, I think I understand what they think, but at some point they have to think in their own best interest at some point.
They like control. They want absolute control, and they have the power. They are controlling us.
Well, you know what that means, then? Ultimately, they're going to be pushing a civil war of some sort over time, given enough time. I really do believe that. Now, you and I may disagree on that, but I think that...
Well, no, I don't disagree, because that's what history tells us happens when government gets so unreasonable that the people no longer tolerate it. Mm-hmm. That's what history tells us. I don't care. You just study history. I don't think a lot of people do study history, but just study history.
Yeah.
And that's what happens.
The one thing that I think might change something here, and I know that this is really kind of a weird thing. Did you read that thing about Scott Bessent saying that that the federal government wants to do a sovereign wealth fund? Have you read into that?
No.
Okay. Essentially, what they're talking about doing is taking all of these federal lands right now. Now, I know there's a controversy right now because Utah has asked for their federal lands to be distributed to them because their Enabling Act, their state admission act, ended up saying that it should. And the federal government's not doing it. But Scott Bessent a few weeks ago was talking with a bunch of the other money guys. And this was on television, you know, when Trump had that big press conference with the AI people. They were doing the $500 billion thing that they were talking about for artificial intelligence. And he was talking about a sovereign wealth fund taking things like our public lands, our public forests, our oil, our mining interests, all these sort of things, and putting it into a sort of investment fund. And it sounds like there's talk about forcing it to be productive. I would be curious to see if that ends up going through. That might force a few issues through the environmental mill or taking it out of the environmental mill that we don't know about. I think it's something worth maybe taking a look at. Maybe you look further into that and we can talk about that another time. Could be a bit of a game changer when you have a country $40 trillion in debt and having to make some money off of these lands instead of burning it and billing the taxpayer. What say you?
Well, yes, I agree with that concept. I mean, it's going to be in the details as always, mm-hmm. but I will tell you, I would adamantly never, never support letting control of the federal lands in Oregon to give to these progressives from Portland. Never.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to give it to the state because the state would have even worse control of it. Yeah, I would agree with you on that. But if it appears that the feds, I'm thinking the reason they didn't give it to Utah would have done good things with it. I think the reason they don't want to give it to Utah and they're going to keep it for themselves right now, the Fed government, is because they know they're broke and they have to generate some wealth. And I think that may be helping us out in Southern Oregon at some point. I don't know how long this will take, but stay tuned, Herman. All right. Stay tuned.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard it, and I don't know it, but a lot of people say that is the collateral for the national debt.
Mm-hmm.
And
if you put $300 trillion of federal land and mineral rights and things like that into an investment fund, do you think you might be able to make 0.5% a year on that, or 1% a year on something like that? And all of a sudden, here's $1 trillion to $2 trillion a year, that sort of thing. It's they're thinking hard over there in D.C. I just want to let you know.
You know, that's the way it has always been up until the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
It was like that. In fact, if you remember the slogan for, I think it was Bureau of Land Management, was land of many uses. Well, that's went by the wayside.
Yeah. Now it's no moo, right? No moo.
Yeah.
No nothing.
Land of only green uses. We're talking about taxes. Hey, they got a new proposed tire tax, too, House Bill 3362. And that money would go into a slush fund for them to use as they want. So,
Tell me that they actually exempt the EV tires. Do they exempt tires for EVs?
I don't know. Maybe we make them out of soybeans or something. I don't know.
Oh, then the rats will eat those, too. Got it. Hey, perfect. We've got all the problems solved now, Herman. Hey, appreciate the call. We'll talk next Tuesday, all right? But look, you know, I know that you're a good money guy, though, a good money brain. Look into that sovereign wealth fund that Bessent was talking about.
I'm going to look into that.
All right, you do that. Thanks for the call. We'll catch you next week, former Senator.
Take care, Bill. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Senator Herman Bearchiger, 8 o'clock, KMED HD1, Eagle Point, Medford. KBXG Grants Pass. Hey, after the news break and all those sorts of other things, State Representative Dwayne Junker caused a big, big deal on the House floor yesterday by reading a government book. Now, when I say a government book, a book that is in a local school district here, it was too dirty to read on the House floor, but it's not dirty enough to be required by the libraries in the schools. Interesting stuff. We'll delve into that and a whole bunch more coming up.
An intelligence solution saves you.